time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Howdy, howdy.
All right, so we're here. We are doing the first episode of A Brew Strong. And I'm here with my co-hosts, John Palmer and
Hello.
Tasty McDowell.
Hi, everybody.
And Brew Strong is a new show that we're doing at the Brewing Network. You might recognize me from that other fine show, the Jamil Show, as Justin likes to say. And that show, we talked about styles and brewing to style, and we got a lot of requests from people about doing more technical brewing questions. How do I do this? Why does the mash pH need to be, around, 5.2 to 5.4? Why is the mash temperature this, or why is, something about, water or extract or anything, any question you have about the technical aspects of brewing to make better beer, how to brew strong, that's the kind of thing we're going to cover here.
That's right.
And we've set up an email address, brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. You can send your email, your questions in to us, and we'll also have a live chat. We don't have a live chat today because this is the first episode, and we haven't really announced it. This is, we're coming in under the radar, and normally one of the things we like is for people to be, live on the show with us and be in the chat room, discuss your questions with other brewers there, other people that listen to the show, and then we'll answer some of those for you live. And we don't want to give you just a quick half-assed answer. We want like a strong answer. We want a full answer. So that's why we have, on the show, we're going to have some of the best experts around. We're going to bring in some of the industry experts to answer some questions for you. And we've also got, some great experts in the studio. Sitting here with me, John Palmer. I think I can't do a show without a John. I always need a John around to
a lot of people
keep me
say
busy
that, yeah.
And just having a John, that's just one of the things, I guess, over the years that I've come to appreciate. And John Palmer, author of How to Brew, which I think is the greatest book for learning how to brew, taking
you
from, knowing nothing about brewing to being, an all-grain expert. That's the book that'll do it. So anywhere you are in your process, when I started brewing, thing for me was, I already knew quite a bit. I was already pretty successful before I got your book, How to Brew. And when I did, I was like, oh, yeah, I already know how to brew. And like I think a lot of people out there do.
Yeah.
And, I cracked that thing open, and I'm like, or I had a question one day, and I'm thinking, I didn't see the answer in any other books, what people are saying. I go through research for things. And then I flip through How to Brew. I'm like, wow, yeah, he's got a good answer in here for this. Oh okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's got some good information. And I started learning stuff from this, and I started reading more and more. I'm like, okay, so there's as much as I know about brewing, there's still stuff in there that I didn't know that was very helpful for me. And so I started giving that book as a gift to people I brewed with, and people that have been brewing 10 years, 20 years. I started handing that out as a like Christmas gift. I'm like, hey, I know you think you don't need this, but, put it by the bowl and start flipping through. And, anything you're curious about, start flipping through. You'll be shocked at the quantity of information in there and the quality. And then John and I, we did a book together called Brewing Classic Styles, which I've pimped heavily on the Jamil Show earlier on. And I think that's been quite successful. A lot of people out there brewing those recipes, and people very appreciative of that. So there's a couple of good books, and John Palmer was involved in both of those.
Well, it's really nice to be here, and I'm looking forward to contributing heavily to the show, and getting back into, you know, reader questions, listener questions, and helping everybody brew strong.
Yep, absolutely. And our guest host in our third chair today is one of my dear friends, Tasty McDowell, Mike McDowell. We call him Tasty. And the you know, why do we call him Tasty? The story, the reality
beers.
Is Tasty beers, very tasty beers. I've said many times, this guy could pee in a glass and hand it to me and say, well, I brewed this, and I'd drink it. I'd drink the whole thing just because, you know, if he says he brewed it, that's all it takes for me to drink it.
That's another good reason for me to watch where I piss. I
mean, yeah, exactly.
He might be trying to collect it, you know, covertly.
Exactly. I mean, it may actually be really good. You know, the guy pretty much processes a lot of beer, so his urine probably does taste probably pretty hoppy, I would imagine, and nice malt character.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Very drinkable.
Yeah.
Well, and good head on it.
That's the thing about you, and I think that makes you a great person to have on this show, is that you know how to make tasty beer. And that's not just a line, that's not BS, that's not making anything up. This guy, everybody, he makes beer that is so drinkable. Everything you brew is highly drinkable. Very tasty. Anybody who knows a lot about beer or knows nothing about beer is going to drink it and go, wow, that's really tasty.
Well, thanks, Jimmy.
Right? And that's why we got the tasting. How? All right, so explain to us in 30 seconds or less how you make really tasty beer.
Well, I think it's I keep it really pretty simple. You know, I pay a lot of attention to the basic elements of brewing. Ingredients are really important, fresh ingredients, good water. And then pay a lot of attention to the process. I really pride myself in a repeatable, you know, brewing process where I can feel the effects of recipe changes or other equipment changes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much the rest is just luck, I guess.
Well, and more than anybody, I think, you know, one of the things you tend to do a lot is talk to other brewers, and you kind of have a pulse of a lot of the brew community, and you're such a likable personality, and, you know, you're so friendly. You get along with everybody, and I think so people tend to talk to you a lot about their brewing questions and their brewing failures, their brewing successes, and you seem to take a lot from that and kind of work it into your own brewing.
Yeah, I genuinely enjoy talking to people about brewing, both, you know, craft brewers and amateur, and because I don't take myself too seriously, I'm really open to what they say. I mean, even if I believe a certain thing, you know, real strongly, I'll pretty much, you know, be able to listen to what they have in mind.
You're willing to try different techniques.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Right.
I take myself so seriously, I have a book.
Yeah. You see, I don't.
If anybody disagrees with me, I go, look, it's in print. You know, it can't be wrong. It's right. It's right here. And then if it's not already in print and I say it and I need to back it up, I just put on my website. And then, you know, then look, it's on the internet. It must be true.
Whereas I say, what did I say? And, oh, typo. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and today we're going to get into the topic of melanoidins. We had some folks that, you know, email us all the time. And one of the things that people email us about on a regular basis is melanoidins in beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are they and all this. And so what we'll do after we take a short break, we're going to get into some listener questions about melanoidins. John's going to present some interesting technical information about melanoids, and we're going to discuss it. We're going to answer some more of your emails, and we'll do that right after this break.
Brew right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The more beer deal of the day.
Announcing the Beer, Beer, and More Beer Deal of the Day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The More Beer Deal of the Day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something.
Find the More Beer Deal of the Day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
White Labs is a leader in pure yeast and fermentation services, serving the beer, wine, and distilling industries from worldwide producers for more than a decade. White Labs has three all-new vials for you to pitch this year, home brewers, so fire up your kettles, fill up your fermenters, and get ready for Cry Havoc, the signature yeast strain from Charlie Papazian. This yeast can ferment both ales and lagers and is great for bottle conditioning, too. Second, a cream ale blend of ale and lager yeast strains. This blend creates a clean, crisp, light American lager-style ale. Last, a Belgian-style Saison ale yeast blend. This blend melds Belgian-style ale yeast and Saison strains to create complex, fruity aromas and flavors. Get complete fermentation quickly with this blend's spicy, earthy, and clove-like flavors. White Labs, your brewing partner for great yeast. These new strains are available now for home brewers, breweries, and homebrew shops everywhere. White Labs, it's all in the vial.
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. Exactly. It's so easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Beer.
The Brewing Network.
Back to your hosts, Jamil Zainasheff and John Palmer. Putting the testicles in technical. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking about melanoidins in this show here. And in the Brew Strong show, where you're learning to brew strong, we're going to be kind of tackling one topic in full, in detail, answering your questions about that topic, answering, having our experts talk about it, whether it's John Palmer or maybe somebody in the industry as well. And our guest hosts will also, weigh in on those. And we want to really kind of give you a mini education about, various brewing topics. So today is going to be melanoids. And Steve in Houston, he sent me an email not long ago. And what he was asking about, he said, he wanted to know about melanoids. He said, what are they and how do I add them to my beer? I've heard, he says he heard that they were good for beer, that they made a better beer somehow. John, what are melanoidins and how do you put them into a beer?
Okay. Well, melanoidins are, they're the browning part of Maillard reactions, or Maillard reactions, however you pronounce the French word. Maillard reaction is often compared to or called caramelization. People talk about, in this wort boil, I'm boiling it for a long time, or I'm trying to boil it hard, to high temperature to get some caramelization, to get a little more sweetness or some, toffee flavor in the beer. Well, those usually are actually Maillard reactions. And these are non-enzymatic browning reactions that occur in all foods. Anytime you cook something, whether it's toast in the toaster or pot roast or grilling a steak, you're talking about Maillard reactions.
Well, that's one of the things I say. When you make the difference between a Maillard reaction or something with melanoidins, that's the difference between bread and toast. With toast, you have some melanoidins that have been developed through these Maillard reactions.
That's right.
With steak. If you microwave a steak, you don't get a whole lot of
you get this melanoid. Gray mass
right.
That...
you barbecue a steak, you grill a steak, you get melanoidins.
You get flavor.
And melanoidins are flavor, a lot of flavor, right?
That's right. So, melanoidins is actually one piece of a Maillard reaction. Maillard reactions, you get esters, you get volatile aromatic components. you get the browning. That's the melanoidin. There's another lower temperature browning reaction that are a product that are called chromophores, which means color something in Latin. And then you have
four color, like the small box of crayons.
Yeah,
that sounds the one you get like when you're at the Chevy's and they give you the kids.
We should put that on Wikipedia. I bet.
Yeah.
The other one is I forgot. No, the third one is antioxidants. You get antioxidant products out of Maillard reactions, and a lot of times in brewing, you'll hear that dark beers have better shelf life than pale beers.
I've experienced that very thing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So those are due to Maillard reactions producing antioxidants. So a Maillard reaction is the combination of an amino acid to a sugar. It's a chemical reaction. It occurs with a little bit of heat and in the presence of moisture, whereas caramelization is a sugar-to-sugar reaction where the sugar breaks down and recombines into different form. And those only occur at high temperatures and very low moisture. Whereas your browning reactions, which, like as we were saying, are cooking reactions, those occur over a wide variety of temperatures. They always occur in wort boils. And each particular beer style, in fact, has characteristic Maillard reactions that occur during the brewing process. Whether you're talking about a Munich Helles or a Munich Dunkel or an Amber Ale or an Imperial Stout, Each brewing process has characteristic Maillard reactions that contribute to the characteristic flavor of that style.
Some more than others, though.
That's right.
So a style with a lot of Maillard reactions would be all your darker beers, the stouts, obviously, and that a lot of that comes from the grains.
That's right, which, again, those dark colors in the grains are Maillard reactions from malting and processing the malt.
And others like a Doppelbock, maybe that's coming from a decoction mash as well, or
can come from the decoction mash, and it can come from the malts themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then
the boil.
These reactions will occur at every stage of the brewing process, and when it comes to us as homebrewers trying to mimic a particular style, the closer we mimic, I guess what you'd call the commercial or standard brewing process for that style, the more our beer is going to taste just like that commercial example. It's when you cut corners, or if you do a different boil, based on your equipment. If you do a high gravity boil for a style, or you do a low gravity boil and then try to boil it forever to build up the wort to get to your target gravity, you're going to get a different beer. It's going to have slightly different Maillard reactions and slightly different flavors than the commercial example.
Well, and I find this to be true also, and I think it's impossible to exactly mimic commercial beer. You find the same thing, Mike?
Definitely, sure.
Because you don't have the same equipment. You don't have the same process in place, and you never will. And I find it odd when people, they go, Brewery X, they do it this way, so, your recipe must not be correct, or, because they put this in there or that in there, or they don't have all those extra grains in there. And the fact is, you're boiling different, or you're fermenting different, or, your grain supply is different. All these things are different. So you need to make some adjustments if you're going to try and mimic a commercial beer. And I think what John's saying here is it's a huge amount of the melanoidins that are impacting that.
That's right. You can get the same overall flavors, from a couple of different routes. But especially if you're going for a beer that depends on the melanoid character, the browning and the aromatics that a Doppelbock. A Doppelbock that's been decoction mashed. If you're really trying to target that style and get it, as true to Polliner, Salvatore, or Celebrator, as you can, you're going to need to more closely mimic the process that they're using, because that will produce the same reactions as opposed to another process where maybe you do a single infusion mash with melanoidin malt. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of the same thing, but it's not exactly the same.
Right. Never exactly the same, but You know, I've always found that a lot of times you try and do exactly the same thing. Again, you're not going to be successful. You know, you have to make some sort of other adjustments. How do you handle this, Mike?
Well, you know, cloning commercial beers is sort of a hard target to hit sometimes. Most of the beers that I consider to be my best beers are usually attempts at that, and then I just get off and end up making another beer that I actually like better than the commercial beer. Maybe I'm biased, but I tended to go towards on the recipe side. If I can't get like a certain flavor in the end product, I don't typically want to go modify my process too much. I might do, like in the case of Illinoisans, I might take some portion of the wort and boil it on the stove and try to get a thicker, you know, concentration of sugars and get more of a reaction. But
I think that's perfectly valid too.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably not doing something like that at the real brewery, but I may have to do that as a workaround, if you will.
That's right. You know, you say to yourself, this beer, you know, in this process is missing a certain something, and I'm gonna do something to accentuate that character and add it in. Yeah.
Yeah, it puts sort of a burden on your palate, or palates you can get your beer in front of, which I tend to do. Because if they say, well, this beer could use a little more melanoidin flavor, then you got your choices. You can go to the recipe, or you can go to the process.
Well, that's a question I got for you, John. So, are the melanoidins that are created through malting, I mean, if we get down to the molecular level,
sure,
the melanoidins created through malting, or maybe not to the molecular level, but the flavor level, can those be, I'm not saying they are exactly, but could they be direct replacements for flavors that go through the boil, let's say, or through some other part of the process? The kilning that happens creates some melanoidins. Are those the same melanoids? Would there be
In general, yes. In specific, it's going to be damn tough. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where in malting, there are a lot of different Maillard reactions going on because, you know, there are literally hundreds of different sugars in malt, mm-hmm, and you know, thousands of different amino acids, mm-hmm, and the combination of those produces, you know, that many more particular reactions and aromatics and flavors and so on.
Right.
So the whether you produce those, you know, particular flavors that you're looking for in a beer in the malting process or in the brewing process, you know, yeah, you're going to get some of the same occurring because, mm-hmm, you know, the same ingredients, but proportions, complements, you know, interferences, you know, in terms of those flavors, this brings to mind a quote from Dr. Michael Lewis where he said, in his case relating to yeast, but, you know, a brewer has two choices whenever he rebrews a beer. He can brew the same beer or he can brew a different beer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every time you change something, mm-hmm, it's going to produce an effect.
Right.
Now, whether that's a big effect or a small effect depends on all the other factors in the brewing. But, you know, in general, as you say, you can produce the same flavors by using particular malts, mm-hmm, as you can by using a particular process.
And maybe it wouldn't be a direct one-to-one like you're saying, you know, if brewery A is decoction mashing and you're adding, you know, something else, it may not be exactly the same, but could be pretty darn close as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, right? Yes, right? That's right.
And the other thing that I know you've been a big proponent of getting the word out on this is that a lot of times people are not experiencing caramelization in the boil. They're experiencing melanoidin development.
That's right.
And it has to do with the concentration of the sugars and the oxygen and stuff like that, correct?
Yeah, moisture level, gravity, you know, the duration of the boil. And one thing I've really been, you know, we've been pushing and we pushed in Brewing Classic Styles is, you know, if the old school way was to do a high gravity boil on the stove, put all your extract into a, you know, 3-gallon pot, add a little bit of water, you know, keep it, you know, a couple inches from the end, from the top so it didn't boil over, boil the crap out of that with your hops, and then dilute it in the fermenter. Well, that produces a whole different spectrum of Maillards and melanoidin formation than if you had brewed, say, a full volume boil of, you know, a lesser gravity that, you know, that concentrates slightly during that boiling time to, you know, the target gravity. Going from high to low is different from low to high.
Well, and concentration of sugars have an impact.
That's right. And the moisture level, too, because the moisture level influences which sugars and which aminos combine. I have a note here that I wanted to mention was that in terms of the flavors, you tend to get the baking type flavors, you know, warm bread crust from your high moisture, low temperature Maillards, and then you tend to get more of the toffee and raisin from your high temperature, low moisture Maillard reactions. So
wait a minute, didn't you say high temperature, low moisture twice?
Maybe let me try that again. Let's see. Let me.
We've all been drinking.
Yes.
This is a beer show, after all.
Oh yeah, I mean that's part of the problem.
So maybe I'm wrong, but
I think I'll have another drink. Huh?
Yeah, a little bit of Red Rocket there helps. Okay, low temperature, high moisture Maillard reactions produce malty and fresh bread flavors.
So low temperature, high moisture is the bready.
Right.
Okay.
Most associated with you know, fresh bread.
And the high temperature, low moisture
produce the toasty and biscuit on at the low end, and then as you take that progression higher temperature, lower and lower moisture, now you get into
caramelization,
a little bit the caramelization to toffee. You get into caramel flavors,
not technically caramelization, but caramel flavors,
melanoidin
derived caramel flavors.
And you can even take that farther into some fruity flavors, such as plum and raisin, and then, you know, into chocolate and coffee also come out of those Maillard reactions.
Which is one of the things you get in Doppelbock. You kind of get those plum, raisin, and I think it's not necessarily all melanoidin-driven, but, you know, melanoidins, other grain flavors, other of those flavors along with the alcohols.
Yeah,
and fermentation, it all kind of plays together to give you kind of a plum, fig, raisin type of thing in some of the Doppelbocks.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The Maillard reactions do produce a lot of key aromatics. They do produce actual esters. They're not the yeast esters, the derived esters. They are in fact esters of phenols. They're furfurols and other, you know, a whole bunch of host of other organic chemistry names that I'm not real familiar with, but you do get these esters coming entirely from the malt, from the Maillard reactions, not from the yeast.
And that's fascinating because I think you can get that again through decoction or through heavy boiling or extended boiling or heavy use of certain types of grains will even add
that
kind of character. And so it's all these Maillard reactions, all these melanoidins that come from these different sources could end up one way or the other. And some of them, obviously, they'll all be different, but they may all be acceptable.
That's right. It's common practice in home brewing. You know, if you don't have the equipment to do a decoction, add a little bit of some specialty malts like melanoidin malt or aromatic malt. You know, to supply some of these flavors that have been produced during the malting process as opposed to during the boil or during a decoction.
That's an excellent point. I think what we're going to do is take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to answer some listener email, although first show, so these are emails that I got separately, but they deal with that exact thing, decoction and melanoidins, and I think that'll be a perfect topic when we come back right after this.
Keep your carboy cap on.
This is Brew Strong.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sean O'Sullivan, the brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco. 6 years ago, Nico Freccia and I opened the 21st Amendment on 2nd Street with the intent of bringing back the local neighborhood brewpub. Well, the neighborhood has really changed over the years, but the 21st Amendment still remains a great place for people to meet over a terrific meal and a tasty pint of beer. In the past, the only way you could enjoy the 21st Amendment's handcrafted beers was at the brewpub. Well, all that has changed. Now, the 21st Amendment beers are available in cans. That's right, cans. When was the last time you had a great beer in a can? Well, that day has come. We're offering our world-famous Watermelon Wheat and 21A IPA in cans. Cans are a better package than glass because cans keep the beer fresher longer, but you can also take cans to places where bottles can't go, like the beach, lake, golf courses, and sporting events. So join us in the revolution to take back the can from the big breweries and crack open a cold 21A craft beer in a can. The 21st Amendment, 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park.
Did you know that every day a brewcaster goes to bed hungry? Did you know that that brewcaster is silently calling for the help of people just like you? Do you know that every day the unicorn and the rainbow have to blow sailors for loose change? For less than the cost of a half-calf, quad-shot, venti, extra-hot soy milk, triple-pump, hazel, low-fat foam, double-cupped macchiato a day, you can help starving adults in Pacheco. Your love can be felt for as little as 7 cents a day. Visit thebrewingnetwork.com/donate to sign up today for as little as $2 a month. Private first class in the BN Army. Buy your way up the ranks as corporal, sergeant, ranger, or colonel with an easy-to-do monthly donation that keeps brewcasters alive and your favorite internet radio station broadcasting. No donation is too small to help those in need. Can't you find it in your heart to share your love with a brewcaster? In return, you will enjoy the wealth of knowledge that comes with every episode of The Session, The Jameel Show, and yes, even that other show. Thank you for listening, and please sign up for your donation at thebrewingnetwork.com/donate today.
Entertainment you want. Information you need.
The Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking melanoidins and how you form them, why you'd want them in your beer, what they taste like, what the whole nine yards about melanoids. I think we covered, John Palmer here, our resident expert sitting in, is covered kind of some of the technical aspects of melanoid formation and where you get them. And now I think we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit and kind of look at the brewing aspect, what you do in your brewing and how that is going to affect your beers and why you do one thing or another. You know, before the break, John had mentioned decoction mashing. And that's a common question that we get from people all the time. Greg had emailed me, and he had said, I want to decide whether or not I prefer a Helles done with a time-consuming decoction to one done with a single infusion. I am assuming, maybe incorrectly, that the melanoidin malt and possibly the Munich is added to give some of the character that would have been there from a decoction and is therefore possibly redundant and may even be detrimental. You know, too much melanoidin, right?
Well, I wouldn't do a decoction with melanoidin malt.
With a whole bunch of, yeah, exactly. Yeah, too vegetal. I've done this before, you know, excessive boiling, excessive melanoidin malts, and you get it tastes like, rotten cabbage. Or just to intensity where it's over the hill. I guess my question really boils down to: would a German Helles brewer doing a decoction use any malt besides Pilsner? And I don't think so. You know, I think most of the cases, if you're going to do a decoction mash, you're gonna stick with just the base malts,
right? Like Crystal. A little accent malt, maybe Vienna. Yeah.
Well, I avoid the crystals because, again, too sweet. And I think your earlier point that you're really not getting caramelization with the formation of melanoidins.
Right.
You're getting something similar to them. Another interesting point on that was a good buddy of mine, Jason, Thunder Chicken Brewery. which is his home brewery. He's out in I think he's out in Texas, and he
explains the large chickens.
He sent me an example of the 70 shilling beer in the Brewing Classic styles, done with the concentrated boil.
Okay.
And you know, there was some caramel flavors. The other flavors, the toasty, the bready, all those things were huge and over the top. To he had kind of overdone it a little too much boil, and the thing that was kind of lacking was the caramel. You know, it had some caramel flavors, but it was lacking. And he reduced it down quite a bit. But again, you don't get quite the same caramel as you do from a caramel malt addition.
Right.
So in a beer like a Helles, where you know you really shouldn't have any caramel flavors, I would go more with like the melanoidin or the biscuity or something like that.
Okay, right. I was thinking like a 10 or a 20, just as a pinch.
Even then, a sweetener.
Probably too much.
A sweetener for me.
Okay.
Now, I have done experiments with a decoction on one hand, and as close as I could, a non-decoction of a basic malt bill, you know, Pilsner malt.
Right.
And fermented them as identically as I could, et cetera, boiled them the same way. And the difference with a decoction is really, for me, didn't seem that significant. It's definitely not worth the trouble. And I know my good friend Tasty McDowell here, now he doesn't do decoctions. Now, why is that, Mike?
Well, I guess the main reason is I don't generally make those beers that require that. But I've made a Doppelbock and had some success with that as an Eisbock. And must have created enough of the traditional flavors that it came out pretty well. I do an extended boil when I'm making those beers. So,
well, and I remember that beer you gave me at it was at the World Cup of Beer in Berkeley back probably 3 years ago or 4 years ago.
What beer is that?
The Eisbock.
Oh yeah,
and I tasted that, and that had pretty rich melanoidin development.
Yeah,
and no decoction.
No decoction. No melanoidin malts. Just all through the boil.
Mm-hmm.
So which malts did you use in that beer?
Oh man, if I can remember or not, I'm sure. No, I can't remember when. I think they were just a standard, you know, the
Pilsner, Munich.
Pilsner, Munich, and some darkening malt, probably.
Okay. Graffa special.
Graffa, maybe, yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, but that, you know, with a good vigorous boil and those malts, you can build that flavor.
Right, and I do a full wort boil, so, I mean, it was, you know. And I do an aggressive boil, so I get a big reduction in volume. So I think that.
Okay, now see, that's another key factor is you're trying to develop melanoidins to do a vigorous long boil.
Right.
So what would the answer be for Greg then? Is it worth his time to do the decoction mash? Is it like the Brewing Classic Styles book has? You know, toss in a little bit of some melanoidin type malts,
aromatic. You know, whatever floats your boat as a brewer. You know,
whatever floats my boat.
I mean, we talk to so many people at the conferences and on emails. You know, a lot of people are just interested in the final product, and a lot of people are mainly interested in the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they love brew day, and then that beer can sit in the fermenter or sit in the kegerator. And they share it with their friends, and they're looking forward to the next brew day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're the ones going to be doing the decoction with the all Pilsner malt, versus someone that's interested in drinking the beer and drinking a good example of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
They can do that like Mike does, single infusion mash, appropriate malts, to build that character without going through the decoction process.
And Mike, what would your take be on it? What should Greg do? Should he add the melanoid malts and go single infusion, or should he do the decoction with just Pilsner malt?
Well, I don't see why you'd want to add the melanoid malts to a Helles. Seems
light touch to get that decoction.
Well, I could see a small amount, yes, but I would definitely consider the extended boil is another way to get there.
So you'd go extended boil any time you're using a lot of Pilsner malt, you want to use at least a 90 minute boil,
right,
to boil off SMM,
right,
which gets converted to DMS,
yeah,
and can make your beer kind of cabbagey and all that. So you need at least 90 minutes, 100 minutes to
Very good point.
Get rid of that properly. For me, my take on it would be very similar to John's. It's like if you really enjoy doing a decoction master, if the process, and for me, you know, the brewing process actually for me is a wonderful thing. It's like a vacation. You know, I get out there and, you know, I kind of tune out the rest of the world and I become one with my brew sculpture and I...
get some nasty burns.
Yeah. No, I've actually not gotten any burns.
You're a lucky man.
All the batches I've brewed. You know, I really enjoy that process of brewing and converting the grains to wort and, you know, making a beer out of it. It's something that's really special to me. Yet I don't do decoction because that's a little too extra special for me. That's taken to the extreme. It's a lot of extra work, and I don't know. I kind of take a certain pride in being able to dial in, know my ingredients well enough to get whatever flavors I'm looking for just off adjusting the recipe and saying, well, you know, you need a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and there you go. You're real close to, you know, what you would have had with a decoction. And for some people, they fully believe in decoctions. Other people, they don't think much of them. I know Denny Cohn, he did a... twice he did decoction experiments that, right. You know, he sent out the samples to people. I've done twice the decoction experiments where I found there was very little difference. You know, there is a difference, but not enough to really justify the work.
Too.
And yeah, and that was the results he got back from independent judging, the blind judging. Nobody could really tell much of it. There wasn't a preference for one or the other. Mm-hmm. You know, I taste a difference in blind tasting, but again, I think whatever you're getting, you can get from the grain. So I think that goes to what John was saying earlier. You know, melanoids are formed in many different aspects of the brewing process,
right.
and what Tasty's saying here, you know, extended boil. Different kind of grains, what I'm saying, or, you know, yeah. Or also, you know, different, you know, mashing or, you know, the maltster. That's why, you know, a Durst Pilsner is different than a Weirmann Pilsner.
That's right.
You know, they're both fantastic products. Can't go wrong either way, but they do have slightly different flavors. Mm-hmm. And those are a fairly low melanoidin grain. You know, there are melanoids from the drying process and the kilning. But definitely not huge, right. Fairly subtle, and I find that really fascinating.
Now, the decoction mashing, I somehow equate that to creating a highly fermentable wort. When I do an extended boil, am I actually making it less? Am I actually pushing that in the other direction? Would that be a reason to do a decoction mash? If I do an extended boil, am I actually decreasing the fermentable sugars?
I think in theory you are.
To some extent. I mean,
because those sugars are converting to melanoidins.
Right.
Which are not going to ferment.
That's not fermentable. So.
Yeah. But the whole purpose of decoction, the reason decoction mashing was invented was because they were working with less modified malts.
Okay.
And
right.
So, you know, they needed that kind of process to break the fermentables
free. To get the enzymes out of there.
Yeah.
Together, right.
So... You know, these days you can. We don't need the decoction for to produce fermentable extract so much as we need it for flavor, and we have other avenues such as specific malts to get the flavors.
Right.
So it becomes, as we were kind of alluding to, you know, whether you do a decoction or not depends on which ingredients you use and your love of the process.
Gotcha. Okay,
but but you are correct that. Doing a concoction will generate, you know, some unfermentables, and you know what you may, especially in a highly modified malt, you're not going to free up any more extract using a highly modified malt. You're probably going to end up with a net decrease in fermentable extract.
Gotcha.
As a result of that reaction.
Well, and you know how the malt is kilned is also, you know, kilning the malt reduces fermentability of the sugars as well. Every little step along the way kind of reduces fermentability. So you also need to be careful, and I think that's a good point, back to Greg's question as to, you know, whether you should add that. You know, the more melanoidin-rich material you're providing, and the more you're creating melanoidins, the less fermentable it's going to be. You're lower your finishing. So there's a lot of questions there. You know, you want to make sure that your overall balance is not excessive. A Munichelis is a bready, rich beer, but you know, well attenuated, something you can drink in quantity. This is something you drink by the liter when you're in Germany.
Yeah.
And if you're not able to drink a liter of it, you're excessive in either, you know, your residual sugars or melanoidins, yeah, or your alcohol or whatever. It should be something you drink in quantity.
Yeah. Let me point out one final thing. The decrease in fermentability as a result of decoction we're talking about here, we're talking about a small effect.
True.
You know, a 5% or less kind of factor, as opposed to where you really notice decreases in fermentability are your highly roasted malts, you know, your black barley, you know, your patent malt. You definitely decrease the fermentability of those malts because of the extensive melanoidin formation that takes sugars, you know, out of solution from what was there previously.
Okay.
But, you know, that's a big effect. What we're talking about here is, in terms of Munichelis and decoction mashing, mm-hmm, small effect in for overall fermentability.
Right. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we are going to get in some more questions. This would be the point where we get into answering live questions from the chat room. And you'd be able to go to thebrewingnetwork.com. There is a live chat button. You click on that, and that will take you in, and you can actually listen to the show live and interact with other brewers that are listening and ask questions. And it's a moderated chat room, and they'll be able to ask those of us here at the end of the show. But today,
we're looking forward to hearing from
you. Just starting out, so there is no live chat today, which it feels kind of weird for me. I don't know. I really love that part of the whole show when I'm doing the Jameel show with John Plisse. In this case, we don't have a live chat. So I got a few more email questions, and when we come back, we will be talking about the boil and melanin formation during boil.
Brew right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
Oh, crap. It's the hop shortage.
No, not the organic, free-range, Oyster Russian Imperial Coffee Stout.
It's all gone. We'll never brew again.
Damn this hop shortage. Damn it to hell.
Oi! F*** away off your wee f***ing hop shortage, f***.
Who are you?
A f***ing Scottish 80 shilling, and you cannot brew a Scottish 80 shilling like you was mixing f***ing cement with f***ing hops instead of gravel, your great f***ing ass.
Use less hops, brew more beer. Northern Brewer has kits and ingredients for dozens of worldwide beer styles that don't require a lot of hops to make a great pint, like the bloodthirsty and abusive Scottish 80 shilling. Keep drinking great beer. Order at northernbrewer.com and get flat rate $7.99 shipping anywhere in the contiguous U.S. One beer kit, $7.99 shipping. 1 million beer kits, $7.99 shipping.
Together we can beat this hop shortage.
My lambic!
It'll only f***ing help it.
This is
www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
Woo-hoo! We're back. Enjoying more Brew Strong.
Indeed we are.
Learning how to brew strong. Well, we're talking about melanoidins and, you know, where they're formed, all this. And one of the things that George Fix had mentioned in, I think it's either Principles of Brewing Science or Analysis of Brewing Techniques, he mentioned that, you know, when you get an evaporation rate exceeding 15%, you know, everything starts to taste like a Bock beer. And, you know, I found that very interesting. And so I've always kind of monitored, you know, my evaporation rate. And what's interesting is I think it depends a lot on the various equipment. Mike emailed me, and he was saying he had met Denny at a conference, and they started talking about boil off. And Denny mentioned that I had mentioned something about evaporation rates, and that Yeah, I had said that it wasn't a concern until your evaporation rate was over 16%, but he didn't recall exactly why or what happened after that point. I'm curious because I've switched to full boils in a converted keg using a propane burner. My evaporation rate has skyrocketed to 25%. He starts with 8 gallons, runs down to 6, and he's wondered, you know, what kind of symptoms is he going to find? What kind of problems is he going to find and all that? Now, here's the thing that I find with evaporation is you can be any, you know, it depends on the equipment again, whether you're direct fire, steam fired, you know, they all, I think, affect melanoidin formation differently. And, you know, boil kettle geometry, all that stuff. If you get past a certain point, you do get a really kind of excessive melanoidin production where it can be offensive in the beer. It can be over the top and too much. And so that's not necessarily a specific percentage, but in general, it seems to me anything between, 10 and 15% seems fine on most homebrew equipment, but it may be the case, I doubt it, but it may be the case on 25% evaporation that you're okay and it's great. Me, I'd turn it down. You don't need the boil leaping out of the kettle and smacking you in the face. You know, people try and get too vigorous a boil. That's the thing we're all taught when we start out homebrewing. Oh, you need a really vigorous boil. So we all crank the burner up to maximum and, you know, wort's flying out and hitting the ceiling. What you just need is an active surface of the beer or the wort so that, you know, the volatiles are being cast off and it's being exposed to the whole boil, the whole wort is roiling through the kettle.
Yeah, professionals talk about thermal loading and excessive thermal loading and, you know, degradation of the foam character, the flavor of the beer, excessive melanoids. And I think if you are getting 25% evolution in a converted keg, because that's a system
pretty standard.
A lot of us brew on 25% is probably. You need to turn the boiler down.
Probably be closer to 15.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, if you're getting 25%, that means the last half hour you've reduced it by, say, you know, it's already at 12.5% reduction. It's more concentrated for that whole length of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That adds to the, you know, the Maillard.
And you're going to get more Maillards, and you're going to get more of the Bach flavor, like George Fix talked about. That type of character where you get the rich concentration of Maillards, melanoidins.
Yeah. My system, you know, with 15%, that's about as high as I can go. And I tend to, you know, the evaporation of that of 15%. And when we talk evaporation rate, we're talking percentage per hour, okay? It's not 15% over the entire time, and when you're going 2 or 3 hours, it's 15%, or you're going a half hour, it's 15%. No, it doesn't work that way. Per hour is how evaporation rates are measured. So if you're at, say 10%, at an hour, in an hour and a half, you've evaporated 15% of the liquid volume, but that's still a 10% evaporation rate. Right. And for me, a 15% evaporation rate is about as high as I can go. I've gone down to 8%, and I didn't care for the beer at that point. Yeah. I think some Maillard reaction, some melanoidin formation is important in every beer that you do. Mm-hmm. And, it needs some boil character, but it doesn't take a whole lot. And it can be overdone, I think, is the answer for Greg or for Mike here. And have either of you experimented much with evaporation rates?
I haven't experimented with it. Mine's typically 12 to 15. I'm usually collecting 7.5 to 8 and boiling down to 6.5.
Yeah, I've just learned over time to, and I measure, you know, I always go for a target knockout out of my boil, and if I'm over or short, I always make, you know, say, well, I must have, you know, boiled too high, so I make a mental note to back off on the boil or increase it next time.
I always seem to have wort left over that, you know, won't fit in the fermenter, you know, because I don't want it boiling, or, you know, coming out the top of the carboy.
Well, and one of Tasty's rants that I think is very important for new brewers or for any brewer who hasn't realized this is adjusting your boil, you know, your results of your boil, you know, measuring your work gravity, you know, after the sparge, before you start boiling,
oh, definitely,
you know, in the middle of the boil, at the end of the boil. You know, I had checked mine before that. But, you know, after you mention that, I make a religion of checking. I do a lot of 90-minute boils. So I'll check at the very beginning. I'll check every 30 minutes and adjust from there. And usually I can just, I'm tracking right along where I usually do because I have a sense of what the boil should be. But, you know, if your volume's too low, you know, and the sugars are too concentrated, you know, that's going to affect your hop utilization.
Yep.
If it's you know thinner or more volume, you know again it affects your hop utilization, your bittering, you know just the volume. Even if it doesn't affect utilization, it's volume.
Yeah,
right?
It can affect the whole balance.
Yeah,
of beer.
You know if you
the
have
malt, hop balance, right?
25 IBUs of bittering that is dissolved into that amount of alpha acids dissolved into 4 gallons versus dissolved into 5 or 6,
right.
It makes a whole completely different beer. And I think that's one of the things that Mike really preaches very strongly. I think it's a very important point.
Does the do we look for like the Maillard reaction in every beer we brew, or is it just something we should only be concerned about in like these big, dark, malty beers?
I think it's something you look that needs to be understood that it occurs in every beer.
Right.
But in terms of what you're driving, I think that's most important in particular beer styles, such as Doppelbock and Brush Imperial Stout, and, you know, the malt,
gotcha.
the heavier beers where you're looking for a malt-dominated character.
Well, and yeah, it's something in part of every beer. That's like I was saying, when I went down to 8% on some beers, it was totally lacking. But, and it's a subtle character. You wouldn't say, oh, that's melanoid and rich, but you'd be surprised without them how insipid your beer is.
Lacking character.
Right.
Yeah. Gotcha.
But certain beers, it's a hallmark of the style. Box. You know, a lot of your bigger beers, your barley wines, it's a lot of your old ale, your stouts, things like that. The interesting thing is from a lot of those stouts, you're getting those melanoidins from adding these character grains, the roasted barleys and things like that. From other beers, again, a lot of it's from the grains or you can get from the boil, extended boils or, especially for something like an old ale or a Scottish ale, you can get from a long boil for the process parts. And I did get another question from another Mike about excessively malty aspect of his beer. He's been getting comments in competition about how barley wine like his double IPA has been. So I tried troubleshooting with him, and what it came down to was he had switched to a different burner, and he had been boiling his wort on the stove on a couple of electric elements, and then he moved outside, as a lot of us are eventually are forced to do.
Thrown outside.
we're thrown outside onto the patio, and then he buys himself a propane burner. You know, it might have been one of these
turkey fryer, 100,000 BTUs or something.
Turn that thing all the way up because now's your chance to really boil this stuff, and you get too concentrated a flame and excessive or melanoidin development that mimics caramel flavors,
right.
And he started getting comments as to his double IPA being like a barley wine.
Yeah, I've always told people I've been using Superb gas burners all my. For the last 15 years, in my brewing, as opposed to the rocket burners, which is like a single orifice hits the center of the keg. These days, you don't see Superb burners very much, but it's the Hurricane burners, or the Cajun cookers, where you have the burner element takes up a good 6 to 8 inches across, across the bottom of the pot, distributes that BTU number that you see on the box. That really helps, reduce that character. Whereas if it's a single flame, you're going to get a hot spot on the bottom of the keg, and you're going to get a a lot more of the it's going to be a hotter boil in that local area than you would get, what you'd get if it was distributed better.
Well, now, you know, here's the thing. I got a good friend, Dave Sapsis, brews excellent beer, and he's got one of them, they call the Jet Burner, and it's like a single, you know, the thing's like a rocket taking off.
Sounds like it, yeah.
And, but, you know, I think he's got a masterful touch with the burner control.
He's got it dialed in.
And he knows exactly how much he can push it or not. And it goes with a fairly gentle boil, and it works just fine. And I think, you know, the ability of the liquid to conduct the heat away, if you're not really pushing it, you know, you're okay.
It'll keep up.
It's the thermal loading.
It'll keep up.
Yeah.
And if you go too much and you're really, you know, heating that metal up, you know, it really cannot conduct the heat away. And, you know, liquid conduction is very effective in carrying away heat, but you can overload it. So you just need to be careful with that. And again, somebody can make beautiful beer doing that. So, you know, it just depends on the brewer more than the equipment, I think.
Yeah. And it sounds like Mike here, you know, he changed burners, kind of a new process, new piece of equipment. Takes a while to dial it in. You know, his first few beers, excessively malty, you know, more Maillards than he was used to in his previous process. He's going to either have to adjust his recipe or, you know, learn to finesse that piece of equipment and to get the kind of flavors he's looking for.
Well, that's what I told him. I said, you know, just back down on you know, your boil. And, you know, see if that results in a better beer, you know, more along the lines of what he needs.
So I'm right, huh?
yes. Yes, you're right.
Okay.
All right, so should we recap here? Do you think you've covered this topic? You know, it's a huge subject with all, you know, we could probably do this for hours on end, but I think we kind of nailed down, you know, the original question from Steve was, you know, what are melanoidins and, you know, how does he get them in his beer? I think the answer is melanoidins are a lot of those flavor compounds that are developed through, you know, things like kilning of the malt and, you know, the boil or, you know, special things like decoction. And
they're cooking flavors.
Cooking flavors. Like the difference between, you know, a piece of white bread and a piece of white bread that's been toasted. Those have melanoidins that have been developed.
Microwave steak versus grilled steak.
Or boiled steak versus grilled steak. You know, those flavors are very important. That's what makes those foods taste so good. This is the same thing on the beer. So, you know, how do you go about getting those in your beer, Steve? You go about it by, you know, for Tasty McDole and myself, and I you know, maybe John's along the same way most of the time. I think you've done some decoctions, but I don't know if you're really in favor of doing them a lot or know, more for the joy of it.
Yeah, the reason I do decoctions is I'm looking for conversion. Mm-hmm. I'm starting out with, you know, Moravian malt, low modification.
He wants to save 5 cents in malt. And so
yeah, I'm going for it. I'm going for the numbers.
He's
going
to spend a couple of dollars in propane. And you have a couple of options there. You know, you can go with your recipe. You can tweak your recipe and, you know, add a little more melanoidin character, like I believe it was Greg that was asking. You can, you know, you can skip the decoction, go that route. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like Palmer here is going, you can do the decoction and, you know, develop some melanoids that way. Or even still, you can develop your melanoids in the boil. Like Tasty here, he relies very heavily on the boil when he needs. He'll go with a longer boil time to develop a lot of the melanoidins. I don't think you really want to go excessive on the heat. Like Mike was having a problem with that hot burner. You know, you need to be careful of that. And it's style dependent as well. You want melanoidins in every beer you brew. It's like every food you cook. You want some sort of melanoidins, or it tastes, you know, very, very, very plain, and so you want them in every beer. But certain types of foods need more. You know, oatmeal doesn't require a lot of melanoidins, but you know, steak needs to be grilled, and you need you know, some char on there and all that stuff, and that's really what brings it home, right?
Mm.
Anything else to add to that recap?
Just said I'm hungry for a steak.
Yeah, I know. I think we need steak and beer. We have plenty of beer here in the Brew Network
salt,
studios.
Black pepper.
Okay, you guys are just out of control now. All right. So, what you want to do is if you're listening to this show live, the next show would be in about 2 weeks. And you'll be able to download, or if you're listening on the podcast, you'll be able to download that in about another 2 weeks. If you're listening live, usually we're going to do one or two sessions back-to-back. And as always, if you're listening live, it'll be posted when the live shows are. You can find that at thebrewingnetwork.com. It'll list when the shows are live. You can join the live chat. Make sure that you're sending us emails at brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. And again, the whole purpose of our show is to help you learn how to brew strong.
Thank you.
All right. Good show, everybody. Brew strong.
Out. Oh.